33. Hanging up the headphones. Everyone has a shelf life, whether they're a finely tuned athlete, a surrogate mother, or a lady newsreader. Disc jockeys are no exceptions. The last thing you want to do is plough on long past your sell-by date, trading on past glories, Simon Mayo, or pretending to like classical music, Simon Bates. The dignified approach is to recognise when your magic is gone and serenely slip away, having negotiated a handsome severance package and delivered a stinging broadside against younger DJs and station controllers. Also Simon Bates, to be fair. I'm perpetually analysing my relevance and fitness for purpose, angrily quizzing my assistant on the quality of each day's show, and sending tapes to Denise and Fernando to flag up anything that sounds dated or fogey-like. So far, nothing has come back. But sometimes there are whispers, nagging doubts, worries. I'm a human being, a good one, but human nonetheless. And the creeping concern that I'm outstaying my welcome has lived alongside me in recent years, like a quiet wife or a sidelined application for planning permission. This has taken on new badness in recent months, culminating in a bounce back to where I was before I bounced back. I found myself walking through the valley of no confidence towards the desert of deep despair. You see, recently there have been whispers that the partridge is past it. Naturally, the naysayers haven't had the testes to say this to my face, but you can sense these things. Plus, I've had my assistant sit behind them in the staff canteen and listen into their conversations. From whence did these hushed conversations arise, you ask? Or at least I do. Well, it was all triggered by an incident in May. Craig Kilty, a.k.a. The Monster, a DJ from rival station Orbital Digital, had tricked his way into my studio and duped me into saying the words, "I listen to Orbital Digital." Far from this being a clever publicity stunt, however, most people just ended up thinking he had learning difficulties, which to my mind he definitely does. Yet it seemed that the chattering classes around North Norfolk Digital had seen it differently. To them, it was a sign that I was letting my guard down, that I was losing my hunger, my sharpness, my joie de broadcast. Of course, that was cobblers slash fucking bullshit. But it still needed answering, and the only way to do that was to stage the kind of one-off radio event that people would be talking about for a generation, certainly in my household anyway. Which is how I came up with the idea of Mid-Morning Matters, Mid-Air. Whoosh! Legs together, arms by my side, I shoot up into the air, my body spiraling like a drill bit. Shit! I scream in terror as my beloved Norfolk disappears beneath me. Up I go, higher and higher, climbing like a bird that flies vertically. 2 feet, 3 feet, four. God knows how many G's I'm pulling. Then suddenly the ascent seems to stall. Norwich, we have a problem, I quip deep inside my own head. But of course we don't have a problem. It's just old Lady Gravity getting her way. She always does in the end, the bitch. And so here I go, beginning my long descent back to Earth. 4 feet, 3 feet, two. As I gather speed, my side parting lifts off my scalp. I can fly, it must be thinking. How wrong it is. How wrong it is. And then kaboom! 13 stone 8 ounces, a bit less if I go to the toilet before I weigh, of pure Alan Partridge crashes down in the forgiving embrace of soft, inflated plastic. A broad Cheshire cheese smile lights up my face. I really do love a bouncy castle. It's August 2011, and you join me at the annual funfair of North Norfolk Digital, North Norfolk's best music mix. A million miles away from our dark, cramped studios. The fun days are all about glitz and glamour, and we broadcast live from a large field or car park. It's a rare chance for us radio professionals to do our stuff in front of a real-life audience, and I, for one, love it. Reading the travel news into an unresponsive studio mic is one thing, but announcing a tailback on the A47... while staring deep into the eyes of a local granny as she nervously tries to calculate the implications for her journey home, well, you can't beat it. I like to spice things up with a gimmick, too. Last year, I broadcast wearing a full suit of armour. Hot, but worth it. The The year before, I didn't do anything. I was going to dress up as David Beckham, but in the end I didn't, as I was in a bad mood on the day. And this year, I've trumped the lot. A first for digital radio anywhere in Norfolk. I've decided that part of my show will take place mid-air as I catapult myself up and down on a bouncy castle. People have tried to talk me out of it, of course, some concerned that the jumping will compromise sound quality, others believing, wrongly, that the castle is only for the use of under-10s. But there's no way I was going to be dissuaded. Because this year of all years, with rumours circulating that I'm past it, I need to make my mark. A few practice leaps have banished the nerves that kept me awake for much of the night. And as I look out onto the small but high-quality crowd, I can feel myself basking in the warm glow of relative confidence. I breathlessly clamber aboard the castle, having first removed my shoes, and quickly scare away any remaining children. Yet barely have I finished my first mid-air "Hello, Norfolk!" than things go horribly, catastrophically wrong. As I reach the high point of my first ascent, I can just make out something odd going on below. A grubby man has rushed forward and is shoving the castle out of the way. Suddenly there's nothing to cushion my fall but cold, hard car park. My whole life flashes before me. It really would make a good film. But before I crash to earth, I notice who the perpetrator is. It's none other than my DJing nemesis, Dave Clifton. With an hour to kill before opening time, he's clearly decided to come and make mischief. This time he has badly miscalculated. What he's attempting won't just leave me a bit red-faced. There is every chance it could lead to paralysis on a truly Perry Mason-esque scale. And there's no way I'm prepared to spend the rest of my life in a wheelchair, even though I've always been curious about the turning circles of the motorized ones. I shut my eyes and prepare for the worst. But instead of the crack of bone on tarmacadon, what I hear is more of a squelchy thud, because Clifton has failed to get out of my way and has effectively broken my fall. Better still, his recent thyroid problem means that to land on, there's very little actual difference between him and a bouncy castle. Yet, as we lie there, in a tangled heap of DJs, I realize I haven't totally escaped injury. My left ankle is badly sprained. As the pain courses up through my body, I yelp like a shot dog. Clifton is pretty badly hurt too. Blood is glugging from a cut in his knee, like a big squirt of leg ketchup. I'm sorely tempted to spit into the bastard's mouth, but don't. I'm worried it might be taken as a sign of affection by any sexual deviants in the crowd. As my mind scans its database for a plan B, he leaps up and starts to run away. Instantly, I'm hurled into the belly of a dilemma. What do I do now? He's pushed it too far this time, but I'm still a professional. I've still got a show to do. My fans are expecting 3 hours of quality radio delivered mid-air. I may have bust an ankle, but there's no reason I can't get back on that castle and hop. But then I look out into the small but high-quality sea of faces. My God, people are laughing at me. Worse, on the front row, I see Craig Kilty, a.k.a. the Monster, and a man who looks very much like Tony Hayes, but isn't Tony Hayes, because Tony Hayes is dead. What I wouldn't give to wipe the smiles off their faces, especially the face of Craig Kilty, a.k.a. the Monster, because it is actually him, whereas the other one isn't Tony Hayes, because Tony Hayes is dead. If I just let Clifton get away with it, even more people will think I'm past it. Even more people will think it's time to put me out to pasture, /stud. Instantly, my mind is made up. Sorry, guys, I say. Show's cancelled. 2 hours later, the pursuit is still in full swing. Struggling with different but identically debilitating injuries, me sprained, him cut, fat, drunk, we're locked in a dramatic low-speed chase. Thankfully for me, Clifton has been unable to stem the bleeding from his knee. Even if I temporarily lose sight of him, I can always tell which direction he's headed because he leaves a small trail of blood. He's like a large, menstruating snail with a drink problem. By this point, my ankle has swollen to roughly the size of a child's head. There's no way I can give up, though. To make matters worse, he's goading me. "You'll never catch me, Partridge. I wouldn't bet on that," I counter as a pregnant woman overtakes me. "Well, I would," he replies, his ridiculous mid-Atlantic accent hanging on the breeze like a bad Trump. "Oh, yeah? How much? How much have you got? Depends if you mean cash or assets. If we're going down the assets route, then we're talking house, car, antique Toby jug, which is chipped, but not badly. Suddenly it hits me. The entire conversation has been nothing more than a smokescreen. With me distracted, he's hobbled onto the number 23 bus and is getting away. Overcome with rage, I flick him the V's, both hands. A young boy misunderstands and thinks I've aimed the insult towards his mother. Keen to defend her honour, he flicks his wrist to and fro in the international gesture for masturbator. I flick my head effortlessly to the right and see another bus pulling in. Hauling my kiddie's head of an ankle aboard, I pay my fare, $150 for a single, and fix the driver square between the eyes. "Follow that bus," I bellow, my face puce with frustration. "Jesus, what happened to your ankle?" he asks, leaning his head out of that little cabin they sit in. "Bouncy castle fall, only partially broken by bad man," I answer concisely. "Now drive." He steps on the gas, and with a massive cloud of dust, we wheel spin out of the depot, our back end bucking like a bronco. But at the lights, disaster! Clifton's bus turns left, mine goes right. I ding the dinger, but as I leap from the bus and onto the pavement, I've forgotten about my ankle. The sudden throb of pain makes me understand what childbirth must be like, except I'm feeling it in my lower leg rather than in my vagina, which is presumably more sensitive. "Are you okay?" says a passing Frenchwoman who's obviously learnt to speak English. I totally ignore her, partly out of pain, partly because I'm still angry at her countrymen for taking part in the Vichy regime. I scan my surroundings. If I can cut across the retail park, I should be able to head him off at the junction. It's a long shot, but it's the only shot I have. I make my way past Boots, JJB Sports and Blacks, who I notice have got a 25% off all waterproof trousers. This is handy not only as I need a new pair of waterproof trousers, but also because I always aim to get them at a discounted rate rather than pay full price. But when I look back over to the junction, the bus has gone. Clifton has eluded me. "No!" I shout, tossing my head back and firing my scream into the sky, although some of it will inevitably have spilled into the nearby Burtons. I trudge on in a daze, making it a few more paces before collapsing to the ground in a tangled heap of DJ. When I finally come round, how long has it been? A few seconds? A few minutes? A few hours? It's a few seconds. I realize where I am. I am lying in a disabled parking bay outside Morrison's. Yet this isn't just any old Morrison's. This is the site of the copse where I stood all those years ago. An 8-year-old, marvelling at a simple maple, bowled over by its class and its spunk. The same site to which I make pilgrimage once a year. To remember that tree and take stock, to remember who I am, and re-engorge my sense of self. But today feels different. Today the tree/parking space feels blank, impassive, solemn. Rather than replenishing my self-esteem, being here seems to be sending me a far more poignant message. As a child, this is where I'd looked ahead to the rest of my life, where my hopes and ambitions had taken shape. And now I am here once more, at the tail end of my career, bested yet again by a rival DJ. The message is clear. I really am past it. Try as I might, I can't ignore what this tree, patch of ground approximately where a tree once was, is trying to tell me. I feel tears welling in my two eyes, for I know what I must do. I must go into North Norfolk Digital, North Norfolk's best music mix, in the morning, and announce my retirement, effective immediately. As the enormity of my decision dawns on me, I bring my arms into my body, tuck my chin onto my chest, and roll away to the left, as a disabled guy wants to get into the parking space. That night, I sit alone on my sofa and prepare to write a goodbye speech to my listeners, armed with nothing other than a pad of paper and one of those biros that writes in different colours depending on which button you flick down. I set to work, choosing black. Memories, people from my past, significant achievements dance before me, like I imagine they would if I was sitting at a fire after drinking the potion in some kind of voodoo ceremony. I will myself to write my goodbye. But that night's bid-up TV is so enjoyable that 4 hours later, I realize I haven't done anything other than making a winning bid for a 12-volt automatic hammer with soft grip handle. I turn off the TV and head into the kitchen to treat myself to a bowl of Cocoa Pops with hot milk, heavenly. And as I'm slurping down a mouthful of sweet brown cereal, I fall sound asleep. I wake at 7 with a bit of milk on my face, but also a genuine sense of clarity and certainty. No time for McDonald's today, I say loudly. I have to say my goodbyes to my colleagues, to my listeners, to the profession that has been my love for the best years of my life. I telephone my assistant to tell her the news. I'm obviously not interested in what she has to say, so when I've finished speaking, I press the buttons on my phone in order to drown out her protests with the key tones. Then I hang up. I start the drive into work, manfully trying to operate the brake, accelerator, and clutch with only one functioning foot. It's not easy, but I'm confident that if I move my good foot quickly enough, whilst slinging my bad one over the gear stick, it can be done. A close shave with a local lollipop lady tells me I'm wrong. I clamber aboard my crutches and begin the long walk to work. It will at least give me time to marshal my thoughts. Some hope. As I struggle to pole vault my body gradually towards the studios, my concentration is crumpled by interruptions. "Excuse me, love," a bespectacled woman asks from the driver's window of a Renault Espace. "I'm trying to find the Millennium Library. I think it's Ethel Street." "It's Bethel Street," I mutter, my eyes fixed on the pavement ahead. "It's just past the end of Earlham Road. But there are tailbacks from the roadworks onto the Grapes Hill roundabout. You're better off taking Dereham Road and heading for St. Benedict Street." "Thanks. I must concentrate. This is a seminal moment in my life. I need this to be right." But a shout from a nearby doorway halts my train of thought. "Lovely day," says an old cardiganed woman towing a tartan shopping trolley and deadlocking her front door behind her, as all old people obsessively insist on doing. "Yeah, for ducks," I holler. She laughs, and I explain. "The weather's going to take a turn any minute. Massive chance of rain today, massive." She stops laughing, and, deep in thought, heads back indoors to collect a coat or buy her shopping online. I arrive at North Norfolk Digital, North Norfolk's best music mix, still clueless as to how I'll announce my retirement. Just before I enter the building, the security guard catches my eye. He looks a bit down, or rather, more depressed than usual. So I engage him in a quick bit of chat, instinctively focusing on topics someone like him will relate to, such as football or the lottery. I get inside and crutch myself to the bathroom. Standing at the mirror, I observe my reflection. My eyes still dance and sparkle. Of course they do. But my hair is mottled grey. My eyes are riddled with wrinkles, and my skin has developed a blotchy quality that I never discovered the source of. "The time has come for me to retire," I mumble to myself. "Yes, something simply feels right." I hear a snigger from a toilet cubicle and curse silently. My colleagues really are twats sometimes. After splashing my face where it had been stained with milk, I leave the bogs and order a couple of less senior people to assemble everyone in front of the foyer. And then I drop my bombshell. "I'm calling it a day. I wanted you all to know first, but in a few moments I'll share the news with my listeners. I've had some great years with you all, I shall say, but the time has come for me to retire." A hush falls over the room. They can't believe it. At the back, I think I see someone faint. I start the process of shaking every member of staff by hand. It's only a small gesture, but I know it'll mean a lot. Some people have got palms even clammier than my own, including a worryingly high proportion of women. But I don't tell them. Now's not the time. I'll just give my hands a good wash later. In the end, I have to do the shakes increasingly quickly, as I've noticed people have started to drift away, no doubt intent on returning to their desks to switch off their email, take their phones off the hook, and give themselves a few minutes to get their heads straight. By the time I get to the last few, it's barely even a shake. It's more of a grip and release. I'm in such a hurry, I end up pressing the flesh of a couple of people who aren't even on the payroll. One is a DHL courier, the other isn't. I'm so determined not to miss anyone that I even head back into the toilets, first the men's, then the women's, then the disabled, to mop up any stragglers. By now, however, it's 9:55, the time for shaking hands with people in toilets, no matter what their gender or handicap, is over. I glance out of the window and see an old woman looking up at the window, through the driving rain, but I've no time to worry about lady pensioners. It's showtime for the final time. I enter my studio for the final time. I sit on my seat for the final time. I warm up my voice, not for the final time. At this point, I was still toying with the idea of joining a gospel choir. As I have done for every one of my broadcasts over some 30 years, I quietly run through my pre-show checklist. Headphones, on. Throat and nasal passages, clear. Fingers, ready to push buttons and slide sliders. The breakfast show has chosen to end with It's My Life, the 1992 hit by Dr. Alban. It seems somehow appropriate, even though it's used to advertise tampons. My moment has arrived. Alban stops, his husky European rap singing slowly fading into the crisp morning air, and then nothing. Silence. I've frozen. I'm committing the biggest sin in radio. Dead air. But it's not that I've lost my bottle. Me? No way. Get real. I'd made up my mind after all. It's simply that I can't muster the will to speak. Something has grabbed my brain like the jaws of a distempered police dog. It's the old lady I've seen from the studio window moments before. It's only now I realize. This wasn't just any female pensioner. It's the woman I'd spoken to earlier this morning. This time she was wearing a coat, carrying an umbrella to protect her body from the drench, and when her eyes had fixed on mine, she'd been shouting something. Thank you, she'd been saying. Thank you. I'd helped that woman. I had genuinely helped her. In providing a simple weather update, I'd helped her to avoid both the downpour and, who knows, perhaps a fatal dose of hypothermia. And it wasn't just her. The travel bulletin I'd given to the bespectacled driver had helped her to, I imagine, return her library books in time, saving her money that she could use to feed her children, and all thanks to a detour away from the inevitable jam back at Grapes Hill. And then there was the security guard. He'd been at a low ebb, but my chat, my breezy demeanour, my easy way with people, had given him a chuckle, a moment of levity, a sign that someone cared. I shake my head. No time for sentimentality, Alan. I need to get back on message, as Tony Blair would say. But still I'm dry-mouthed and unable to propel the words towards the foamy orb of the mic. But now word has spread that I'm drying up live on air. People are pouring into the studio that faces mine, others are peering in through that little round window in the studio door. It's only a small window, but I can count at least 3.5 faces. But still I can't do it, because I'd helped people. I'd amused, I'd chatted, help, amuse, chat. Those qualities, help, amuse, chat, are qualities that broadcasters spend a lifetime trying to perfect. Yet, on the limp to work, I hadn't even had to think about it. It was like breathing, or going for a wee in the night. It had all come so naturally. It was just Alan being Alan. Partridge being Partridge. Me being I. But shouldn't I be saying, sod them all? Sod the mockers, the naysayers, the bouncy castle saboteurs, whatever they think of my broadcasting, isn't it my audience that matters? I mean, for them, I'm doing a good thing, day in, day out, except weekends. Help, amuse, chat, help, amuse, chat. I look back to the window. Now my assistant is there. She's holding up a plastic bag with some sandwiches in. Is this a sign? No, probably not. Suddenly the producer is in my ear. Speak, man! His voice seems to go into slow motion. Speak, man! I go to loosen my tie, but realize I'm not wearing one. So instead I just end up scratching the bit below my Adam's apple. As I drag my nails back and forth across the base of my gullet, the producer is back in my ears. Snap out of it, Alan! Dozens of eyeballs peer at me. Thousands of ears strain to hear. I lean towards the mic and finally, I speak. This is Alan Partridge with Mid-Morning Matters, and on the day that 67-year-old Norwich resident Mary Lees has woken from a 3-year coma, we'll be asking, what's the best night's sleep you've ever had? We'll also be looking at the law and asking, are you legally allowed to draw a line down the back of a photograph and use it as a postcard? Now, though, the best band ever to come out of Liverpool It is, of course, China Clisis. A deafening roar goes up around the station as people realize I've shelved my retirement plans. I go to shield my ears from the noise, but suddenly an ecstatic throng of well-wishers is rushing into the studio. Two oldish receptionists struggle to lift me onto their shoulders. Dozens of others reach over and hug me, although there's absolutely no physical contact between myself and my assistant. Instantly, everything feels right again. I am back where I belong. I am I. Partridge. So, dear listener, our time together is over. All that remains is this short epilogue, and anyone who thinks it's designed solely to haul me over the minimum word count specified by my publisher is very, 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 very wrong. Instead, it's a chance for us to reflect. Having heard this audiobook, I'd like to think you've come to know me a bit better, because in a funny kind of way, I feel I've come to know you. Shall we be friends? Yes, I think we shall. In a spiritual sense, anyway. Please don't come to my house. It's my belief that in the last few hours, we've been on a journey. Literally, in the case of those hearing this on the train or bus or in the car, less so for those on the sofa, in bed, or reading aloud to a blind friend or lover. Now, however, the time has come to bid you farewell. I've been through much in my life. I've scaled the highest highs. I've plumbed the lowest depths. And though I sit here today with a heavy heart and a weary soul, my eyes still burn brightly. They burn for a better tomorrow, for a world without famine and war and the BBC. And, if you've enjoyed listening to my story, I urge you to go out and buy 3 hard-backed copies of I, Partridge, We Need to Talk About Alan. Take one for yourself, give one to a friend, and give one to an enemy to heal the wounds of the past. Goodbye, and aha. We hope you've enjoyed this production of I, Partridge, We Need to Talk About Alan by Alan Partridge with Rob Gibbons, Neil Gibbons, Armand Iannucci and Steve Coogan. I, Partridge was produced by Scott Sherritt, Mike Merritt for Harper Audio, recorded by Ethan Donaldson. Executive producer Joe Forshaw. Text copyright 2011 by Rob Gibbons, Neil Gibbons, Armand Iannucci and Steve Coogan. Production copyright 2011 by Harper Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this.